The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
It was on regular rotation most weekends. I don't even know how many times I've seen Stand By Me, but it's been many.
The terrible Australian, Be Jermaine.
And he pretty much just yells out, misery's alive, misery's alive. Oh, this whole house is going to be full of romance. Oh, I'm going to go put on some Liberace records. I don't know why that line just killed me for some reason.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
There's some serious going on. And here I'm like, the what is this? Why?
Mature themes.
King himself and also Mick Garrison, how they sort of stage how this virus sort of spreads and everything, was just very eerie and very unsettling for me.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the King Zone podcast from the Super Network at supermarcy.com. This is a podcast that takes a deep dive into the film and TV adaptations of the works of Stephen King. I'm your host, Super Marcy, and this is episode 21. And on this episode, we will be talking about three films, which are the TV film Quicksilver Highway, Apt Pupil, and Hearts in Atlantis. Of course, I am joined by the one and only, my trusty co-host and BFF, the one who could be terrible, we're not sure, Bede Jermaine. Hello, Bede, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Very excited for this episode of The King Zone.
Indeed, indeed. We have a lot to discuss on this episode with the three films we're going to be talking about today. And they're kind of all different degrees in terms of like in terms of what their stories are and also their styles and tones, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, especially with one of them in particular I have never seen before, so I'm definitely excited to talk about that, but also to talk about the other two, which I haven't seen for a very long time, and excited to talk about those because there's definitely a lot to discuss with both these films.
Yes, we actually have a lot to unpack with this episode, and I just want to give a shout out to our friend Paul Huffman, who was meant to originally join us for this episode but has unfortunately had some scheduling conflicts, and hopefully he'll be able to join us in the future for a King Zone episode. As we know, he is a big Stephen King fan from the books and also the TV shows and films, so hope you're well, mate. I understand moving can be challenging and time consuming. So big shout out to you, and hopefully we'll see you on the King Zone very soon.
Indeed. Definitely look forward to Paul being on the show. I'm a bit sad, and of course he couldn't make it here, but I do look forward to when he does eventually come on, because it has been a while since we've had Paul on the show.
Yes.
But I definitely look forward to when he comes on next. But that being said, though, I am looking forward to discussing these three films.
Yes, I'm very excited to discuss these three films. Nah, that's a bit of a lisp or something. I don't know. Edit that part out.
No, it's all staying in, Marcy. We're not professional on this show.
Damn it. That's To Be Tuesday's Bede.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes it seeps over onto our other shows. But then again, did all of this already seep over to the To Be Tuesdays?
Yeah, might have. I'm not sure. I'll start that again. I'm very much looking forward to talking about these three films, and we will jump right into it with Quicksilver Highway.
I am Quicksilver. Aaron Quicksilver. You might say I'm a collector. I collect rare objects, facts, stories. I travel the roads of America seeking its heart. Do you have a time for a story? There is no light without darkness, no life without death. peace without war, no God, no, without Satan.
What are you doing, man? I said pull over! I'm gonna broke your neck! You're not gonna wreck us.
Oh no?
So why'd you call it? No!
If you can't see the black heart of America, you're either blind or a fool. Just a man with a tent filled with wonders and a handful of stories in search of a willing audience. Do you have time for a story?
Which came out in 1997 as a TV film. It is a kind of an anthology because there's two different stories. It was directed by Mick Garris, based on stories from Stephen King and Clive Barker. And the cast of this one includes Christopher Lloyd, Matt Frewer, Raphael Sabage, Missy Crider, Silas Weir Mitchell, Bill Nunn, Veronica Cartwright, Bill Bolander, Amelia Henley, Cynthia Garris, and big cast. Some familiar faces, obviously. And the synopsis for this one, which I have gotten all this info from Letterboxd because I do love Letterboxd. The film is actually 2 one-hour stories, the first based on a Stephen King story called The Chattering Teeth, about a man who picks up a hitchhiker, and the second is based on a Clive Barker story called The Body Politic, about hands that rebel against the body. Now, I had previously seen this probably over 10 years ago, as I did my Dissecting the Director column back in the day for Arrow in the Head, and I did one on Mick Garris, so I watched all of Mick Garris's directorial work for that. So I haven't seen this since then, but Bede, you have not seen this one before.
Indeed. This is my first time watching it for the show, but I've known about Quicksilver Highway for, like, forever, mainly because I remember because one of my best mates, Todd, when we were teenagers, I know for many, many years, I don't know if he still thinks this or not, but I know for a long time he kept saying that that this film was like the worst film he had ever seen. although sort of in hindsight, especially with all the stuff I've seen since then, I'm like, my poor little summer child. but that's the thing, how I sort of first became aware of this film was, of course, my friend's disdain for this film. But I always remember, like, seeing the video of this down at the video shop because it was always there all the time. But I'm not sure why I never picked it up, even especially during that kind of period in my teens when I was getting so much in the horror and I was just pretty much renting out everything I could get my hands on. So I don't know why this one in particular sort of, like, sort of bypassed me. But I was very excited that we are talking about it on the show, especially but mainly because I wanted to find out if isn't it really as terrible as my friend Todd says, or if it's like actually a lot better than it's been given credit for. And I guess now having watched this film, it definitely is not good, but it is watchable. And I think the main reason why that is, and I think why I think a lot of people probably would not like this film, is that, and this is something you messaged me about the other day, is that this is a film that is very, very campy. Which seems to be, you know, because we've talked a lot about Mick Garris on this show and also over on our Podcasts of Horror. Yeah. And he's definitely a director who I sort of noticed now sort of watching a lot of his work or revisiting a lot of his work lately, is that he's definitely a filmmaker who has a lot of sincerity when it comes to his work, but also isn't afraid to be campy with his work as well. Particularly, you know, Sleepwalkers, which is probably the zenith of, like, of his work in terms of camp. But, I mean, I don't think Quicksilver Highway is as memorable as that film. And there's definitely a lot of things about these two, about this film, that don't really work for me. But, like I said, it is watchable and there are some fun aspects to it. But strangely enough, though, since, you know, we're probably going to be more focusing on the Stephen King aspect of this two-part anthology film, which is the Chattering Teeth segment. But funnily enough, though, I think of the two segments, that one is probably my least favorite. And I think the body politic, the Clive Barker story that Mick Garris, you know, adapted to this TV film, was the more fun and more interesting of the two. But yeah, I mean, it is a watchable TV film. And I can definitely see why this one has been kind of forgotten in over time. But there are some interesting things about it, even if I don't think it really entirely comes together as a whole.
Yeah. I agree with you on Mick Garris. He's definitely not afraid to take risks. And that's something I do admire with his work because, you know, if anyone has obviously listened to previous episodes of this podcast and Podcasters of Horror, I do quite like the works of Mick Garris. I do like the man, you know, as a person as well. And he's actually given us a lot with horror. And I really appreciate all of that. And we talked previously, like, how much we liked and admired the Stand miniseries. And, of course, our love for the campy classic that Sleepwalkers is. And I do love Sleepwalkers. This one's kind of a mixed bag. And I'm not sure, like, where it all kind of stands, because it was sort of a TV movie, there's obviously some limitations. So it does look a little, no, I don't want to say like cheap, but not the biggest budget in the world. Some of the effects don't look the best. But I think the Mick Garris's style, I think, actually worked better for the body politic. And I think it actually should have been way more over the top for Chattering Teeth because there was potential for that to really work. Like, it is really hokey as a story, at least the way it is presented here, because I haven't read what it's based on or whichever. But that one, like, in itself, just this thing of these chattering teeth that will attack you and kill you and stuff, like, that is so ripe for something on the camp and crazy level of Sleepwalkers, but it really doesn't go there. It just almost goes through the motions, and I think that kind of lets it down. And I think, like, the actors that were in that part, I think they actually did fine. It's sort of still kind of hokey, and it kind of works. But I think there was just something missing for this to be, for at least that segment to be slightly better. But I will say, as kind of the, I guess we kind of call it the Crypt Keeper sort of putting the stories together, we've got Christopher Lloyd as Aaron Quicksilver, so is the title. I actually quite liked his very bizarre performance that wraps around the whole film with this weird cautionary tale. I thought that was a good, I don't know, it was just a good, like, get as far as he goes. But he just went for it, and I think I really liked that part about it. I feel like I'm talking way too much on my own, so please interject, Bede.
Well, I was going to say, like, I think... Christopher Lloyd is quite solid in this film. And you can definitely tell he's having a lot of fun playing this sort of like storyteller character who runs into all these people. And I guess another thing I found interesting about this film is, like, it, in a way, even though it's like a 90-minute film, it feels like two separate episodes of a TV show that were basically sprung together, because you got the first half with the Chattering Teeth, which is, you know, Aaron Quicksilver sort of meets... Melissa Kreider and you know, her car's run down, her husband, played by Raphael Sabat, has gone to go get help, and hence why it's, you know, it's a highway. And so basically that feels like you think most of the film is going to be set on that section, but then once that story finishes, then we're just transported to, like, this theme park. At first, you kind of feel a bit disorientated because it doesn't feel like a way like an actual anthology film is structured, because, like I said, it's like these two, it feels like two separate episodes of a TV show just stitched together and just made into a film. And it doesn't surprise me because, like, you know, looking up on the background of this film, because originally I think in the early development of this film. It was originally meant to be a TV anthology series.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think John McTiernan, and John McTiernan, the director of, you know, Die Hard, Predator and that, he was actually going to direct a lot of the episodes of this show, but then, of course, things came up and he couldn't do it. And that's why, if you notice in the credits, he has an executive producer credit.
Yeah.
But then Mick Garris, of course, got involved and he sort of started writing the scripts and that. But then the studio decided, oh, we don't want to make a TV show. Let's make a TV movie. So that sort of would explain that why this film feels like two separate episodes of a TV show strung together to make into a film. But back to Christopher Lloyd, like his character, he is, of course, like our storyteller character. And you can tell he is having a lot of fun. But at the same time, though, I was really put off by the way he looks in this film, because the outfit he wears as Aaron Quicksilver is probably one of the most bizarre costumes I've seen in anything lately. And I've recently rewatched Bram Stoker's Dracula as well. and I swear, and I don't know about you, but I swear he is wearing the exact same wig that he wore as Uncle Fester in Adam's Family Values when Fester gets married and he has that weird, like, mushroom-looking orange hair, but it's more messier here. It looks like exactly the same, and I just could not stop staring at it.
Yeah, no, yes. Considering all the movies we watch for Tubi Tuesdays and we're saying Christopher Lloyd looked very bizarre in this movie, says something. but, you know, like, he actually brings a lot of charm. Which is something that he just does naturally. And I just wanted to touch on briefly, just going back to that this was kind of meant to maybe be an anthology series. So this is kind of like almost a precursor to Masters of Horror.
Which definitely.
Was the horror anthology series. And, you know, with this story, what I thought was interesting, because we kind of have these characters that interact with the Christopher Lloyd character, is that the husband and wife, and then the husband's character is then acting in the actual story being told as the main character. And then for the body politic, where he's at like a carnival and Matt Frewer's character comes in, sees this hand with candles on it, and they have this talk, and then suddenly Matt Frewer is the main character in the story being told about a plastic surgeon. I thought that was actually a good little thing. And I think I was saying this to you like over messages as I was watching it, that I, you know, it's not the best. It is watchable. It has some campiness to it, which I think adds to it. But and like Christopher Lloyd has said, brings a lot of charm, but I do think there is a bit of charm to this. Yeah. And that makes it just a little bit disappointing that I think they could have reached stronger heights, but unfortunately it doesn't. But I think it's still watchable, and it's an interesting view for a collaboration between, you know, Mick Garris, Stephen King, and Clive Barker. And again, going back to Sleepwalkers, we did see King and Barker on screen together.
Indeed, and in the body politic segment, and this is another sort of trademark with Mick Garris. He likes to have a lot of people in cameos. And, of course, Clive Barker appears and as an anesthesiologist in that segment. But also John Landis appears as a co-worker of Matt Brewer's character in the hospital scene. So, although I'm surprised that Stephen King doesn't make a cameo in this film. And because you think he would.
Because but, I believe like they have some family members and stuff actually make cameos in it as well.
Yeah, like Mick Garris's real-life wife, Cynthia Garris, like plays Matt Frewer's wife in the body politics segment. So there's definitely, like, and it's interesting because, like, looking at when this film came out, this movie only literally came out 2 weeks after The Shining TV miniseries, which Mick Garris directed. So this came out, like, legit 2 weeks later. So it seems to me like he was, and I know a lot of the same people who worked on that miniseries also worked on this TV movie, so they must have literally made them all back to back. Yeah, and of course released them like 2 weeks apart.
Yeah, that's crazy to think about. Like, did they stop working like at all?
Oh, yeah.
Bloody hell, giving us so much to watch on this podcast.
I guess for me, of the two segments, like I said, I think Chattering Teeth, like I said before, definitely is the weakest segment to me, because like you, I do agree. It seems like this is a kind of Stephen King story that he could, you know, he could do in his sleep. Like, and it does feel like, and I don't think this is really the fault of Mick Garris at all. I just think as the story itself, it just feels like it's going through the motions and it doesn't really have anything like to add outside of its kind of unique concept at the center, which is like this pair of large chattering teeth with legs, like this mechanical steel chattering teeth with legs that can spring alive and attack people. But it only really happens in the scene where Rafael Savage's character, Bill Hogan, who picks up this hitchhiker who, played by Silas Weird Mitchell, who, funnily enough, is named Brian Adams. and they even make a joke about that in the film. But I have a feeling, though, that maybe he only said that, like, because he just saw the scene. It's like, oh, yeah, my name's Brian Adams or something like that. That's the kind of the thing I got the impression of. But, and then the teeth sort of come alive because Bill Hogan picks it up as a present for his son. And then they attack Brian Adams. I'm just saying Brian Adams way too much on this episode. and then after that, he drags the body away. The teeth drag the body away, which is a kind of a hilarious sight to see. And then after that, like, Hogan comes back a year later and sees Veronica Cartwright. As a lot has changed, like her husband, who she ran this petrol station with, he has died. And then the teeth just show up. And then it kind of just ends on a very anticlimactic note.
Some storm, huh?
Yep, pretty nasty.
Oh, not too shabby, man. All the creature comforts.
Well, you know, I do a lot of driving.
Where are you headed?
Los Angeles.
LA, cool, man, me too.
Okay, let's get a couple of things straight here.
Yeah, no problem.
First, I don't usually pick up hitchhikers, all right? I had a bad experience a few years ago, and you might say it kind of vaccinated me. Now, I will take you through the foothills, but that's it. There's a truck stop on the other side of the interstate, Sammy's. I'm sure you won't have any trouble getting a ride from there. Okay?
Sure, man. That's cool.
Second, if you really feel the need to smoke, we part company right now.
Sorry, man. Didn't see that tube there. No cigs. Got it.
Right. Bill Hogan.
Brian Adams.
Okay.
But the body politic, though, does feel more like a complete story. And I think Matt Frewer is great in this segment because it's a very physical performance, and it is a very silly concept. The fact that literal both like hands have become sentient on their own and want to start a revolution against humanity.
Yeah.
So they want the hands so that they have to get cut off and literally go against like humanity. It's a very silly concept that shouldn't work, but at the same time, it kind of does because it is fun, and I think it also has a bit of it knows how ridiculous of a premise it is. But at the same time, though, Matt Frewer is giving it his all and just selling it throughout this whole segment. And it actually feels, like I said, a very complete segment overall. Like, this could easily have been a whole episode of Masters of Horror. Although I think it's interesting, though, because, like, the way that this... Because we sort of, like, how we watched it in that. I know there's a bunch of this movie out on YouTube, so if people want to check it out, there's like a whole bunch of links. But the thing is, though, I sort of noticed with a lot of them, like, they change the structure. And so sometimes the body politic is the first segment and sometimes Chattering Teeth is the second. And I thought, okay, that's a weird thing. But then I found out that When the film was released on home video, they actually, in some places in the world, they actually switched the order.
Oh, that's weird.
Of the structure. So Body Politic in some places in the world, especially on when it was released on home media, was the first one, followed by Chattering Teeth. And I think Mick Garris was a bit annoyed by that because he felt Body Politic was the more climactic of the two and was probably the better segment to end the film on, which I can understand because if Chattering Teeth was the last one, you would feel very underwhelmed. Because it's just a kind of a, compared to Body Politic, it's just not that interesting of a short, I would say, compared to like the insanity that is Body Politic.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is weird because why would you put them like the other way around? It just doesn't work. And yeah, I think if Chattering Teeth had more of the insanity of the Body Politic, I think it would have actually benefited because it is so silly. And, you know, the way it kind of ends with that character just like getting the teeth back, and it's like kind of forebodes that maybe he's going to use the teeth on his enemies. Like, it can be an interesting concept, but it just felt way too kind of played it safe in a way. And I think it really shouldn't have, because I think it would have worked a lot better. And I think that's what actually it was with the Body Politic, because that does go insane.
Yeah.
And it has some really dark moments as well as the insane moments.
Oh, yeah. Like, even I really love the final seconds of this film. It's basically spoilers for this film. Like, basically, the evil hand revolution is defeated. But then all of a sudden, the nose revolution begins to start because a random character's nose starts twitching. And basically, it's almost like it's now the nose's turn to fight back against humanity. And I think what's also hilarious, and the thing I just could not take very much seriously about this segment, is that not only are the hands sentient, they can talk.
Yeah, like they can talk. Yeah, they talk. And I was just sitting there kind of giggling when, you know, Matt Frewer's character is like lying in bed and his hands are having a conversation, and then the wife kind of looks and doesn't quite understand what's going on.
Yeah.
But then when the hands kind of really take over and he starts like to actually be physical with her in a violent way, it gets a bit dark. And I did read that that was a bit of a scene to film as well. And you can kind of see. And then it does go very insane, like really insane. And you think, oh, so is this how Thing from the Addams Family got there?
Actually, funnily, you should mention that because the hand that does all the hand stuff in the Body Politic segment was done by Christopher Hart, who actually played Thing in the Addams Family film.
Oh, there you go.
So it's the same actor doing the hand acting, I should say.
So that very well could have been the wig from the Addams Family values.
It would not surprise me at all.
Bit of an Addams Family connection for some reason in this one. But yeah, this one goes absolutely insane and it does get very silly, and the effects are a bit hokey, but it kind of, you know, you kind of appreciate that they tried. It kind of adds definitely to it as well. But this one's a very kind of little bizarre one, but it's also, I think, an interesting one to see, you know, with sort of in the TV limitations, what this ended up becoming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Like I said, I don't think entirely works altogether because, like, I think there's one, like, really entertaining segment and just one kind of kind of segment, and it's kind of unfortunate, given that this is a Stephen King film and TV adaptation podcast, that the one that I felt like was the most was the segment that's based on a Stephen King story.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, we have covered a few other anthologies with a Stephen King story or all Stephen King stories, and it's very interesting how they all kind of just differ from each other so much. It's interesting, but I think that probably wraps up our Quicksilver Highway discussion. And as we always do, we'll give a rating out of 5 for each film we or TV whatever we talk about. So for this one, I'll start again. For this one, my rating is 2.5 weird Christopher Lloyd outfits out of 5.
I actually have to agree with you. I give this about 2.5 out of 5 weird Christopher Lloyd wigs. because like I said, there's one pretty decent segment and one not so good segment. And I think even then as a whole, like it is a watchable anthology film, but I feel like, yeah, I think if Chattering Teeth were a lot stronger, or even if maybe Garris picked a better kind of story from Stephen King's work to adapt, I feel like Quicksilver Highway probably would have been a lot stronger as well. And I would even say even the host segments with Christopher Lloyd, as entertaining as he is in those segments, there's real kind of no real reason for those segments, because like even like Matt Frewer says in the segments, like, okay, you told me the story, like what's the moral of the story? And he just keeps saying, oh, there is no moral. Not every story needs a moral. And it does make it kind of feel a little bit tad pointless, even though Matt Frewer does get arrested for being a pickpocketer like a few seconds later. But yeah, even then, I feel like if those sections as well had a little bit more done as well, I think Quicksilver Highway would have been a better overall.
Yeah, film. Like the messages, I think, were the morals were kind of there. But I don't think they made as much. I think if the actual overarching story segments with Christopher Lloyd, if they actually connected a lot better, like we just get the idea is like this kind of traveling thing, but you don't really get a sense of what it is. I think if that made more sense, and if we took Chattering Teeth, like the volume on that is about 4. If we cranked that up to 10, I think it would have been insane and glorious.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That was Quicksilver Highway. Now, Bede, would you like to introduce the next film we are talking about?
Indeed. We'll move right along to our next one, which, of course, is the 1998 psychological thriller Apt Pupil.
I want to hear about it.
Hear about what?
Everything.
What everything?
Everything they're afraid to show us in school.
Far from the shadow of suspicion, far from the scene of any crime, Todd Bowden has discovered a secret.
If you could let me in for a minute, I just want to talk.
Talk? I don't have anything to say to you, boy.
You were there. You did those things.
I'm an American. You've no right to come here and say these lies about me.
I have your fingerprints. I have your photographs.
What do you want?
I want to hear about it. Everything.
Between innocence and experience.
To the whole world, I am a monster. And you have known about me all this time.
Between curiosity.
What did it feel like?
And conscience.
Lying to judges and reporters isn't as easy as you think. Can you do that? I know I can.
Todd Bowden is about to learn a valuable lesson.
I wonder if you'd mind if I ask you a personal question.
Not at all.
What'd you do during the war?
If you don't believe in the existence of evil, you have a lot to learn.
Todd Bowden, you said that was his name. He wanted to know everything. That was how he put it, yes. Everything.
Which was directed by Bryan Singer, who, of course, a lot of people would know as the director behind quite a number of the X-Men films and as well as The Usual Suspects. The film was written by Brandon Boyce, which is based on the novella Apt Pupil by Stephen King, which I believe was from his Different Seasons novella collection. And the film stars are Ian McKellen, Brad Renfro, Bruce Davison, Anne Dowd, Elias Cortese, Joshua Jackson, Heather McCobe, Joe Morton, James Caron, and David Schwimmer. And the plot summary, which I'm reading off IMDb, is... A boy blackmails his neighbor after suspecting him to be a Nazi war criminal. Now, Marcy, there's definitely a lot to discuss about Apt Pupil, like even as a film. But I think it's pretty important that, at least for a little bit, that we also need to acknowledge that Of course, you know, this film is directed by Bryan Singer. And even though as a filmmaker, he can be a talented person, but he is also a very controversial figure as well, because he has had allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct in the past against, like, young men. So I think that's important that, you know, we acknowledge that, and also that we do not condone any of the actions that he has been accused of. But like we have done with other podcasts in the past, whether it's this show or other ones that we have done have projects that are made by controversial or problematic figures, we will treat the film that we are discussing very fairly on its own as a film. But we will, you know, of course, at least acknowledge the sort of the troubling aspects of Bryan Singer as a person. But with that out of the way, though, but Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Apt Pupil.
I think, look, in discussing Apt Pupil, it is really difficult to not bring up certain aspects with Bryan Singer. And look, at this point, I think everyone knows what the allegations were, how deep it went. There, you know, there's been documentaries and all sorts of stuff. So we kind of know. And when you look at this film, knowing all of this, it kind of changes things and it makes you think a lot more, because this feels like almost a personal story in a weird way. And look, I was going to reread the novella in prep for this, but I might have to do a bonus episode on that because I didn't get time, and I have two copies of Different Seasons, a paperback and a hardcover, and I can't find either of them. I digress. So I'm just looking at that. I know Bryan Singer actually did make some changes from the novella. There is toned back violence. The relationship between Brad Renfro's character, Todd Bowden, and Ian McKellen's character of Kurt DeSander, it was a lot different in the novella. It still keeps kind of these similar aspects of it, but the film does change it, and the ending is quite different. So he made these changes as well. And it is a really, knowing what we know and then watching this, it is very bizarre. And it actually made me wonder if this was almost Bryan Singer telling a story about something that happened to him when he was younger that was abusive. I'm not saying that it happened. It's something I'm wondering. Or whether he was a perpetrator of it. I don't know back then, but it's how you can view this film looking at the changes he's made. With some of that now out of the way, and having rewatched it since I had not seen it for quite some time, I still find it a very intriguing film, like on the surface, with this kind of, you know, these characters who embody this evil about them, and the stuff with the Nazi element, because the character that Ian McKellen plays is a wanted Nazi war criminal. So he, you know, that character in itself has done a lot of horrible things, but this young boy who finds this fascination with that, it's almost like when you as you're watching this, and I don't quite think I picked up on it back when I was younger, is the way it's presented in the film. Is Todd, the character, have these really evil tendencies, and by meeting this man and pursuing this friendship, that it just really kind of harnessed this energy that he then unleashes? I found that quite interesting. And it sort of does change the themes a little bit with the novella. And again, I'll have to come back to that at a later time. And I feel like I'm just babbling. But it is an interesting film to see the dynamic of these two, where it is very abusive in a lot of ways, and how almost the character of Todd is like fetishizing. I don't know what the right word I'm supposed to say, damn it. It's almost like he does that with these horrible things, but he's also shocked by it.
Hmm.
And then you see the progression of this character, but it is a film where you don't like either of them. You don't feel sympathy for either of the characters. I feel like you almost feel bad for anybody who's around this because it's so toxic. Mm. I've been blabbering a bit too much again. But yeah, Bede, give us some of your thoughts upon rewatching Apt Pupil.
Indeed. Like, I also should state, like, I think the last time I'd watch Apt Pupil was probably since 1999.
Like, yeah, I remember watching it.
I remember being, like, a sick, like, for probably a week or two because I might have had the flu. And I think I was just staying at my sister's place and basically just, you know, what I did basically all day was just watch movies. And I do remember Apt Pupil being one of those movies I watched.
Mm.
And, like, I liked the movie at the time, from what I remember. And rewatching the film again, like, now 22-odd years later, I still very much like the film overall. But sort of knowing, like, all the things that have sort of happened in, you know, in Bryan Singer's life, like, I can just see a lot of things that in this film got kind of mirror a lot of the things that he has been accused of throughout his career. Mm. And we should also state that this film in particular was where the first, like, of those accusations first started, because there's a shower scene, which Brad Renfro goes to, you know, the high school shower block. He's in the shower. And then all of a sudden he starts dreaming that he's in one of the shower blocks at a concentration camp. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of older Jewish men around him. And that's sort of this nightmare scenario. But I know that early during the filmmaking of that scene, a lot of the actors in that scene were actually underage. And, of course, you know, they accused Bryan Singer for basically just trying to, forcing them to get nude on camera and stuff like that. And of course there was a court case, and then I believe it was settled out of court. But don't worry, that whole sequence was reshot. So they used a lot older actors for that scene. So this is basically where the first of that kind of stuff happened. But watching this film though, kind of knowing all this stuff that has happened throughout Bryan Singer's career, like a lot of the stuff that happens, at least on a subtextual level of this film, whether it was conscious of Bryan Singer or not, or maybe knowing what we know in hindsight, a lot of that stuff sort of adds a very unsettling feeling.
It does.
For the film. But at the same time, though, it also makes it very interesting as well, because to me, and I was telling you this, you know, the other day, is like Bryan Singer to me as a filmmaker is what I would call a journeyman director. He's not really an auteur, like, you know, like a Martin Scorsese or Steven Spielberg or a Francis Ford Coppola, where you're like, you watch their films and you're like, oh, this is the, you know, all their trademarks, and they like, you know, I wouldn't say he's an auteurish director. Like he does have his own style and stuff, but he's somebody who kind of doesn't really put himself in a lot of his work. Cause I mean, this is a guy who's most of his work has been either superhero films or blockbusters or the occasional kind of historical film, you know, like, Valkyrie or Bohemian Rhapsody, or even like crime films like The Usual Suspects. But Apt Pupil, for me, I would say is probably one of the first films that I've seen of his work, and I've seen quite a lot of Bryan Singer's work, where I just kind of feel like this is maybe the only film of his where I felt like I could get an insight to who he is as a person.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a very, it feels like a very personal film. And the fact that, you don't pick up on a lot of this stuff with other films he's done. Like, I am 100% convinced he has some kind of Nazi fascination. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, I know he's Jewish in real life. And I know, like, with the X-Men films, what really, you know, made him want to do those films was, of course, you know, the sort of how the mutant characters were subjected and, you know, sort of to ignorance and bigotry and stuff like that. And of course, you know, the X-Men stories have always been a metaphor for injustice, intolerance, bigotry against either minorities, races, or creeds. And I can definitely see him, why he was interested in being in those films, at least if there was any kind of thematic elements of that project that would have interested him. But like you say, like, I guess maybe, I know this was a passion project for him because he read the story when he was 19 years old, and he knew then that he wanted to make this story into a film. And he even turned down directing like The Truman Show, The Devil's Own. So after when he, you know, The Usual Suspects became a huge critical and box office hit and won all the Oscars. So he wanted to make this film because this was a passion project for him. So I do agree with you that, you know, this is a film that you could, he definitely was very much passionate about, whether or not like the things that, you know, this film explores with its stories was something that he was actually thinking about within himself with his own problematic life, or if it's maybe he was unaware and that's probably what drew to him with on an unsubconscious level. It's kind of hard to say, but even then, as unsettling as it is, it does make it an interesting watch overall.
Yeah, like, again, you just look at, like, this with the Nazi, the Magneto's history in those films of being in concentration camp, then, of course, Valkyrie, which is about an attempted assassination of Hitler. So there's definitely things that he has wanted to explore or has explored with the films. And, yeah, you know, as you said, like, he really wanted to make this. And I think from what I'd read, I'm not sure if it was true, factual, whichever, that I think Stephen King gave him the rights to this really cheap.
Yeah.
To actually make it. And, and yeah, again, like, because it feels like a very kind of personal film, you just wonder, did he have some kind of, and I'm not, say this is just me assuming how this film goes, some kind of relationship with an older figure. I'm not saying anything mirrored that or if it's something he explores, but the way it's explored with this, it's very unsettling because the character of Todd pretty much bullies this the Dasunda character into reliving the atrocities that he committed after he finds out like who he is. It's almost like he is egging this man on to unleash the evil within because Todd sees it in himself. And we see that through everything that happens, Todd is not like at all reformed in any way.
Yeah.
He pretty much goes up to David Schwimmer's character, who's the guidance counselor at school. And I have to say, I forgot David Schwimmer was in this film. And for the few scenes he's got, he's pretty good. He actually comes across a lot older than he would have been at the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, he pretty much blackmails the teacher to say, you're inappropriate with me if you say anything. And that's very fucking worrying as well, knowing the things that we know.
Yeah.
And that there's no real resolution with Todd. He doesn't learn anything. And it could have been an opportunity because the ending was changed.
Yeah.
To from Todd, you know, going on a murder spree to what we got, which is blackmailing the guidance counselor. It's very bizarre. Very, very bizarre. It's kind of icky in hindsight. And I just don't think, honestly, I think the ending needed to have been changed in some way because I don't think the way it ends in the novella could have been pulled off. Especially during this time where there was going to be, and there were a number of mass shootings in the world.
Yeah. And I think this was probably, because I know this would have came out just before Columbine. So if that sort of stuck with the original ending, this film probably would have been very much buried. But I think for me, as unsettling as the new ending is, I feel like it's much better because it gives us more on how manipulative of a character Todd is. And I never even really got to the cast of this film. And even watching, because I always, like you, I knew, like, Brad Renfro and Ian McKellen are in this film. And I believe this was the very first thing I ever saw Ian McKellen in. And, you know, I think their characters are very interesting and very complex. Like you said, they're not very likable, but there's a lot of interesting layers and complexity to both of them. And in a lot of ways, it's basically, because I know Bryan Singer said that this he sees this film as a study on cruelty. Mm. And also, like, in a way, on how someone can be groomed by evil and to do horrible things. And but at the same time, though, like you say, like, the Todd is a character, like, even though he's, like, the Sander is, you know, obviously is a very evil character, because, I mean, the man's a Nazi, but Todd, in a way, like, over the course of this film, starts to become evil in his own way. And we get to see a little bit of that at the beginning, just to see how manipulative of a character he is, because he's someone who follows DeSander around and pretty much suspects him of being a Nazi, and he does all these things, like he dusts his mailbox, takes photos of him, but then, of course, he blackmails him. Mm. And does a pretty good job. And even DeSander himself is almost taken aback just how this 16-year-old kid, who Brad Renfro at the time of filming was 15 years old, which makes it even more astonishing, because his performance is without a doubt mature beyond his years. But then again, reading up on the late Brad Renfro, like, a lot of people always sense a maturity from him as an actor, even as a young age. Even, like, some people, when he was like 12 years old, thought he was like, it already in his late teens when he was like only 12. So there's a lot of maturity in his performance, and he brings such a haunting quality to that character. And of course, his transformation throughout this whole film is kind of interesting. And once we get to the ending with David Schwimmer, we see that he's become a different type of evil. Like, he'll do anything to get his way, and even if it means destroying other people. And of course, you know, there are moments throughout this film where things like where DeSander and Todd are separately doing other things, but yet they kind of mirror each other at the same time. Like, there's a scene where Todd, you know, deliberately murders a pigeon with a basketball, while that sort of offsets with something that DeSander is doing. And, you know, it's just these kind of things where it's very clear that the film is making sure that these two are kind of mirrors of each other, but they're evil in their own way.
And once they were in the chamber, how long did it take?
Like a minute, 5 minutes?
The prussic acid took about 15 minutes. But the monoxide could take an hour, sometimes more.
What happened to them? I mean, exactly.
It was a mess. They would lose control of their bodies. They vomited, urinated, and defecated themselves. Even though the gas came in from the vents in the ceiling, they would climb on top of each other, desperately reaching for fresh air. That wasn't there. They died in a mountain of themselves.
What about the children?
On the bottom.
Did anyone ever survive it?
One time, the gas didn't work. There was a leak in the pipes, so oxygen mixed with the monoxide. It was horrible. But after an hour, they were still moving, stumbling around the room like drunks, their eyes glassy.
What did you do?
I ordered more gas, but we didn't know about the leak. Soon they began to twitch all over, like they were dancing. Some even fell to their knees, laughing this terrible, high-pitched squeal. Even the guards were frightened.
And it's kind of interesting because, of course, you know, DeSander's more evil in the sort of the Nazi way, but Todd is, a different type of manipulative type of evil.
Mm. It's the way I think it the story comes across is that Todd kind of uses DeSander as a vessel to unleash this inner evil that Todd has inside him through the things that he does. And it's there are also aspects in this film that I don't think I actually had even thought about until this rewatch, is that there is some other undertones, and you sort of get a bit of, and I don't want to word this wrong. I'm going to struggle with trying to say this, but there is, while there's like not sex or anything in this film, there is kind of undercurrent of, with Todd, perhaps, you know, struggling with his own feelings, because he kind of gets, you know, obsessed basically with this character that he's turning down, you know, getting with the girl at school, where he's not even getting, you know, he's not getting excited about these things. And there is some of that, you know, elements in there, which I never really noticed. And I apologize that it's a little bit difficult for me to articulate, because I don't want to sound like a moron.
Yeah, I know the film, like if you go to the Wikipedia page of this film, there definitely is a section that talks about the homoeroticism or homophobia or subtext of this film. So you're not definitely the first person to kind of pick something up in that regard.
And, you know, you could kind of pick up on some of that with, you know, some other stuff that obviously Bryan Singer has done, when you look at, you know, what X-Men is all about. But yeah, look, if I look at it as just a film telling a story about the depths of evil and the depths of evil within humanity and how the film plays, it's an interesting one. I think it's actually really well acted. As you said, there's a lot of maturity, for as much of a dick the character of Todd is, within the performance of Brad Renfro. Like, you know, he had been acting from such an early age, and he always really presented this quality that was very genuine but very mature in the works that he does. And Ian McKellen, while being about 20 years younger than the character he was playing, you know, having a very bizarre kind of accent, and you're just playing this very evil character, I feel like he just added a bit more to what we got through his performance. Like, I feel like these were the right kind of actors to sort of get into this, you know, for this film. And I think everyone around, like, in the film is actually really good as well. It's still, like, taking out the problematic stuff, it is still very unsettling, because this deals with a lot of uncomfortable things, with this very bad, you know, relationship that is very abusive and, you know, gets violent at points. I think, you know, you probably, there would be a way to kind of make a more faithful film on the novella, but it would be quite difficult. So, that's kind of just my ramblings anyway.
Yeah, I could, like you said, because you've read the story, you said that the original story is a lot more violent compared to this film version. But I think at the same time, though, kind of turning down the violence and focusing on the relationship between Todd and DeSander actually kind of made, at least for me, much more engaging, just seeing these two people and on how they engage with each other and sort of like the evil that is going on between them. And like, I forgot, like I said before, like, I knew Ian McKellen was in this movie and Brad Renfro, and even, David Schwimmer was in this film, but this movie has a lot of actors who I was not aware was in this film. I didn't realize Bruce Davison was in this film, or Elias Koteas is in this film, Joe Morton, and also like Ann Dowd, a very young Ann Dowd's in this film, and also Joshua Jackson plays Brad Renfro's best friend.
I completely forgot, like, my 90s boyfriend Joshua Jackson was in this.
Indeed, and like, and other actors as well. And I'm like, wow, this movie was really, had a really stacked cast. I mean, some of the act supporting cast are not, I will admit, weren't given as much to do compared to the two leads. But even then, like, they still give pretty solid turns regardless, though. But at the end of the day, it really is like Ian McKellen and Brad Renfro's show. And yeah. it is sad because with Brad Renfro, like, he did pass away very young due to, I believe it was an accidental drug overdose. Like, I think, like, in the late 2000s. And he was one of those actors who, like, in a lot of the stuff I've seen, he was definitely a powerhouse of an actor. Like, he had, like I said, he had a maturity. And, of course, he had his, you know, demons as well with his drug addiction and that. And it's just unfortunate that he was taken away from us so soon, because he definitely was a very great actor, and especially when you watch him at this age, just how strong of an actor he was. And if his demons never kind of took over him, just imagine like the career he would have had.
Yeah, it's very sad to think about, because, you know, growing up he was in a lot of films that I watched, and he was like one of, you know, those ones I used to watch all the time. So it was it's still really sad to think about. But just going back to kind of the subtext, you kind of get that a lot when DeSander's with the, not the trash can man, Elias Koteas, because he pretty much just thinks he's taken him in to have his way with him, kind of thing. So there was a bit of that there. I just think, as you were talking, I was just thinking that as well. But, yeah, look, it's probably, like, not, it's not an easy story, obviously, to adapt and tell. And at least for the most part, I think this kind of gets somewhere. But then when you add in everything else we know now, it kind of changes things a lot. And it's not the easiest film to watch, knowing a lot of things and picking up on a lot of things. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is what it is. It's a film that exists. And we'll give our ratings for this, and we can talk about the film that would have been with this as well. So, I think I've said like how I felt. So my rating out of five for this would be 3.5 out of 5, based solely just on the film aspect without anything else.
Indeed. I would say it's about 3.5 out of 5 as well. Although I keep going back and forth, because some moments I think, 3.5, and other moments I think 4. I'll stick for 3.5 at the moment, because I do think that, I mean, regardless on, you know, Bryan Singer as a person, I do think, like, to me, this is definitely, and I mean, he's made a lot of films I've enjoyed over the years, but this is definitely one of his most interesting films, and it's definitely a very underrated piece of work of his as a filmmaker. And even knowing the kind of everything we've known about him in recent years, and watching this film in that light, definitely shines a light on quite a few things that happen, or at least on a textual level with the film story. But even if you take that out, it is a pretty dark story on just about the nature of evil and us being influenced and groomed by it. And I think, regardless if this was directed by Bryan Singer or not, it still will be a very sort of a dark, troubling film, and that would be hard to watch for anyone regardless.
Yeah. I think the nature of this story was just very dark. But, you know, maybe we all should have paid a little bit more attention to just how personal of a film this was.
Definitely.
But, definitely. Just some more sort of facts, I guess. Once the novella came out, this Apt Pupil was actually going to be a film in the 80s, and it never got finished. The production actually ran out of money.
It was going to be directed by Alan Bridges, but I think up to this point he only made like TV films, so he was going to direct the film. And in this version, Todd was going to be played by Rick Schroeder, and DeSanda was going to be played by Nicol Williamson, who of course played King Arthur in Excalibur. So they, like, I believe they actually shot quite a lot of the film. They did about, I believe, 3/4 of the film were completed. And then, of course, like you said, money ran out. And I know the producers definitely scrambled to get more money to finish it off. But by the time, then it got to a point where basically Rick Schroeder kind of grew out of the role. And they basically abandoned the film. And I believe, I think I read somewhere that like edited together, there was like at least about 50 minutes odd of footage that has never been seen anywhere. Like it has never been released. But I know that Stephen King himself has seen the footage and he actually did say that it was very good. So yeah, I kind of curious to see, like, because we would have had it, like you said, we would have had an earlier version of this story in the 80s. And a part of me, like, would love to see what how different of this version would have been compared to the version we ended up getting in 98.
Yeah, because I think the story was obviously because Bryan Singer made changes. Or one new channel, you know what I mean. The original version, and I'm going on the Lost Media Archive. I believe the actual story was closer to the novella in terms of that, at least on IMDb, the synopsis reads, Todd Bowden realizes that Kurt DeSunder, a Nazi criminal, lives in his small town. Soon Todd blackmails DeSunder into telling him about the gory details in exchange for not turning him into the authorities. Soon, DeSunder's stories take a toll to force Todd into punishing the neighbors. So it would have been somewhat different.
From the sounds of it, it would have made Todd into basically a serial killer because he does start murdering people. But here, like he does kill Elias Cortese's character, but during when he's being attacked by him. But even then, I think it's more interesting, at least for me. Like I haven't read the original story, but I found it more interesting that kind of taking a different approach to Todd by making more of an evil character who uses manipulation to get what he wants and to ruin people's lives rather than actually physically killing people.
Yeah. I mean, it would be really interesting to see like the unfinished film, like what they shot, what it would have been like. It's not been seen or, you know, no one's really seen it as Stephen King that he saw the footage. And that's about all we know. So yeah, just a bit of interesting stuff that you know, what could have been essentially.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But and next and final film for discussion on this podcast.
Indeed, and that of course is the 2001 film Hearts in Atlantis.
Don't trust people who move their things in paper bags.
Oh, hello, folks. I'm Ted Brodigan. I'll be living upstairs for a while.
Where'd you live before you came here?
Some other place that wasn't as nice as this.
You're a very strange person.
Shh, tell no one.
Have you kissed her yet?
Yuck.
Well, you will, I promise you. And it will be the kiss by which all others in your life will be judged.
Is everything okay? Wake up. What just happened?
I know certain things, see certain things. Some think of it as a gift, but to me it's always been a burden.
So what happens when you touch people?
Might have a job for you, kiddo. I want you to keep your eyes open.
For what?
Fellows who are dangerous.
So what do they look like?
Well, they wear dark clothes, dark hats. They're kind of faceless.
What they want is me. Back under their control.
Don't worry. I won't let the boogeyman get you.
Which is directed by Scott Hicks, who's an Australian director, and of course is the Oscar-nominated director of the film Shine. The film was written by William Goldman, who we've talked about on the show because he also adapted the film Misery. Mm-hmm. And this film is based on the story Low Men in Yellow Coats, a novella that was featured in the Hearts in Atlantis collection by Stephen King. And this film stars stars Anthony Hopkins, Anton Yelchin, Hope Davis, Mika Borum, and David Morse. And the plot summary for this film, which this time, though, I'm reading from Letterboxd, mainly because the one that's on Letterboxd is way better than the one that's on IMDb, is, what if one of life's great mysteries moved in upstairs? A widow mother and her son's lives change when a mysterious stranger enters their lives. Now, Marcy, there's definitely a lot to talk about with Hearts in Atlantis, tell us your thoughts on this film.
Yeah, actually, you pointed out a lot of the strange similarities with Hearts in Atlantis and Apt Pupil is that the young stars both tragically passed away young.
Yeah.
You know, both extremely talented actors and ones that I actually really, you know, loved watching. And it also kind of focuses on, and this one is a different relationship between someone who's younger and someone who's older, whereas the one we saw in Apt Pupil was quite abusive and all evil. This is a paternal relationship where the young Bobby looks at the character of Ted Brodigan as more of a father-grandfather type figure, and that's the kind of bond that they have, which in turn gets very misinterpreted by the mother character. So, it's been a good few years since I rewatched this. This might actually be one of the first films I have managed to rewatch/watch that had Anton Yelchin in it. That was just very shocking when he passed away, and he was like, you know, one of my favorites, and you know, he just had that kind of face that you just want to take him home, adopt him and look after him. And especially, you know, in this film, like, he was just so adorable. It's like you want to look after him. And he just brought this incredible performance to, like, I think it was maybe his first role.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely one of his first, because I believe this was his fifth film, but it was the fourth that was released in the same year, which was 2001. So.
Just what an incredible performance from when he was, you know, so young in this film. And I remember seeing it back when it came out, and I just thought, this is an incredible film. It's just so beautiful. It's mysterious. And, you know, rewatching it, maybe I like it even more. I was in tears watching this again, and partly, yeah, because we don't have Anton Yelchin anymore, but it's just so, I don't know, it's just such a weirdly beautiful film that just really, I think, hits on so many levels. And I noticed so many things I never quite picked up on when I had first watched it. This is a film that's definitely left an impact on me, and maybe even more so after this watch. What are your initial feelings on Hearts in Atlantis?
Yeah, well, it's been a little while since I'd last seen this film. It would have been quite a few years as well. Rewatching this film again, this film is definitely even better from what I remember. And what I didn't love so much about this film, and like what you said before, like how what I pointed out the other day to you is like, this film and Apt Pupil are kind of the yin and yang of each other. Like, you know, Apt Pupil, of course, being sort of like this sort of dark film about this relationship between this older man and young boy. But Hearts in Atlantis is definitely the kind of the more optimistic and more impressionable and more loving side of that. And this sort of between this older man, played by Anthony Hopkins, and, of course, this young boy, played by Anton Yelchin, and just how much their relationship with each other, like, helps their own lives, but particularly Anton Yelchin's, especially because, you know, his father has been dead for years, and his mum, played by Hope Davis, has been busy with work, so she's not around as much. But of course, you know, both these main characters, Anthony Hopkins and Ian McKellen, like, they're both characters who are on the run from people who are, like, government figures who are looking for him. So there's definitely that connection there as well. And of course, you know, they're period pieces, like this one set during the 60s, at people during the 80s. You know, and there's a lot of just sort of like a lot of like thing aspects of it that I just thought was so interesting, and like how they sort of, they literally are like the yin and yang of each other. But on its own though, Hearts in Atlantis, I think I agree, is just a beautifully made coming of age story. And Anthony Hopkins is just wonderful as Ted Brodigan.
He's really amazing. Mm. He really is. Like, I think both of us have, you know, always been fans of his work as an actor.
Yeah.
And it's roles like this where he just brings so much, and you feel like there is this really caring, like, grandparent to grandchild relationship where Ted is almost here to kind of help Bobby heal from, you know, the loss of Bobby's dad and the mum not really paying all that much attention to him. He's almost like this outside entity that comes in to kind of heal Bobby and his mum in this emotional level, and to kind of do away with the bullshit. Like, it's this really genuine thing, and he just captures this so well, and they both do. Like, they have so much chemistry that you would believe that was his granddad, and they would just, you know, hanging around reading some newspapers and going to the fair, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's so hard for me to just, like, again, I have trouble articulating a lot of things, but just the emotional response, I guess, is like, you don't want to see anything bad happen. And as you realize, like, these, the men that are after Brodigan are getting closer, your heart breaks for Bobby because you know he's going to lose this, like, father figure in his life. And, but it's just this beautiful kind of story that sort of culminates in a lot of forgiveness and moving on. I just find it so beautiful. Like, I feel like crying literally. And funny facts about this film, my sister actually was did some travel stuff when they were filming this.
Okay.
Indeed she did. One of my sisters. I have two. I'm not saying which one.
But yeah, and also I want to talk about Anton Yelchin as well. I got, like you and a lot of people, I was deeply saddened when he tragically died suddenly. And I always thought he was a great actor, but even just, like I said, I hadn't watched this film in quite a number of years. And re-watching this film, especially with his performance at, I believe he might have been 11 or 12 at the time he did this film, like, you can't help but get emotional because just how brilliant he is in this film. Like, again, like Brad Renfro in At the Pupil, it's a performance that's so mature beyond his years, but at the same time, though, there's still that child quality to him. So he's not like a kid pretending to be an adult. Like, he's still very much a kid who is, you know, going through the same type of stuff we as kids at that age were going through. But he is just so just fantastic in this film. And you can't help but, like I said, feel so much emotions because, like, he's so brilliant in this film. And at the same time, that he was taken away from us way too soon. And just seeing him, like, having a performance where he is, like, for any actor, especially an 11-year-old actor who's going up against Anthony Hopkins, it would be such a tall order, but he does it with such ease, and their relationship with each other is so moving and beautiful.
You knew, didn't you, where the Queen of Hearts was?
Yeah. It was like I could tell everything that was going on in his head. So, every thought he had, I knew it, and you couldn't fool me.
Can you tell what's going on in Sully's head?
Nah, Sully's head's always empty.
Oh, yeah? Maybe I'm thinking of getting a new glove for next year.
You are? Well, what about that one?
You really want it?
Are you kidding? I love that glove.
Then Bobby Garfield, it is yours.
It is?
I'll leave it to you in my will.
Sully, you just love doing that.
Jack! I got you again.
Wait, no.
You know, when you're young, you have moments of such happiness. You think you're living in some place magical. Like Atlantis must have been.
Oh, hey, Carol, I owe you $75 and it's your turn. Okay. Here, give me 25 back.
25?
Here.
Okay,
here.
22.
No, hold on.
Oh, yeah,
here. Then we grow up. And our hearts break in two.
Like, it is a very sentimental film, but it still works. It's not being, like, overly over-dramatic or being manipulative about its emotions. Like, it plays it very subtly. And I forgot how, for most part, this is a very subtle film and how it treats its story. And even with Ted Brodigan, like, he's a psychic who is on the run from the government because they want to use him for government work. But what I think is interesting, because the original short story and also the whole Hearts and Atlantis collection, the tech cap is very much tied in, and this is based on my research, I haven't read this myself, is very much ties into the Dark Tower series, like is tied into that series. So William Goldman had to kind of eliminate a lot of that stuff to kind of simplify it down for this film adaptation, because it would be too confusing, like having all this Dark Tower stuff if it was still in there. But I think even and I know Ted Brodigan is actually a major play in that series, because I think he appears in the final book as a major character. So, but even then, though, like, even with eliminating that stuff, it still doesn't affect the story, and it's still really well done. And even the subplot with, you know, Ted being on the run from the low men is still quite tense, because, you know, like, you know that they're out there and they're looking for him, but as they're, but then, of course, like Ted says to Bobby, like, keep a lookout for the signs, men wearing hats or actual signs that may have hints that they're looking for him. And like, you could sense that sort of tension that they are getting closer and closer. And it is, on that level, it's still quite tense. And of course, you know, this is a film about, you know, Bobby's coming of age. Like, he's in love with the character of Carol, played by Mika Boerum, who's great in this film as well. And also, this film isn't afraid to get dark. I mean, there's a school bully who basically
is a dick, like every Stephen King fucking bully ever.
Yeah,
and even Harry Dolan, you're a dick.
And even this character, even though Brodigan pretty much sort of, like, since he can read minds, he, like, knows the real reason why he's a bully, which of course gives us at least a bit of empathy to that character. But at the same time, though, later on,
he's still a dick.
Yeah, he dislocates Carol's, like, arm with a baseball bat. We don't see the actual thing happening, but it's that scene where she, like, Brodigan is helping to put her, you know, put it back into her socket. It's such a heartbreaking scene, because the performances in that scene are so real, and she's great and Anton's great. And of course, like, and I also like that the film Hope Davis as the mum, she's really good as well. Like, there are moments where you do not feel sympathy for her character, but at the same time, like, you can get why she is the way she is. And of course, something terrible happens to her as well, which definitely explains why, at least in the third act, where her mind is and all that.
Yeah, you understand where everything kind of comes from, because, you know, someone she probably thought she could trust, who clearly all of us are like, no. Does assault her very badly. And as soon as she gets home, she sees, you know, the girl on the bed. You've got Brodigan there. You've got Bobby there. She has no idea what the hell's going on. So she assumes the worst, which of course isn't the worst. He was, you know, fixing her injury. And, you know, she then, does her own thing and reports Brodigan in. What I actually find interesting is that we don't know much about the Low Men or much about Brodigan. It's like almost he, like I said, he's this entity that has come to kind of heal Bobby and the mum with everything that's happening, like fix this rift between them. And we sort of, the sort of plot that we kind of get, and I think it's good that it's not wholly explained, is that we understand he's got these psychic abilities. He can read minds. And if people do come into contact with him physically, like touch his hand or arm or something, they get some of this power as well, which we see Bobby gets with the scene with Alan Tudyk where he takes all his money.
Yeah.
And I where everything is.
And I was like shocked. I was like, wait, Alan Tudyk was in this movie? I completely forgot he was.
Yeah. And so we kind of get the idea that these Low Men are probably like from the government who want to use Brodigan's power for something.
And we kind of get a bit of a hint of that because like at one point, Bobby's reading a newspaper that says, like, Richard Nixon denies wanting to use psychics to work with the government. So you at least get a little bit of a hint of, like, why these Low Men are looking for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it gives you enough that it's still mysterious that it doesn't kind of ruin this, you know, mysterious element with it.
And also, like, we have to mention that David Morse is also in this film, and we love David Morse here on this podcast.
Yes.
And this is his second time being a Stephen King adaptation we've covered for this show because he was in the movie that I like to call The Longleers. But he's put to good use here, even though he is kind of used in the present scenes because he plays the older version of
plays older Bobby.
And I know from my research is that these modern day segments were partially based on another story from the Harton Atlantis collection called Heavenly Shades of Night Are Falling. So and even though he's only in the movie for such a short time, he still gives a really strong performance as well, particularly because he's going back to town because his best friend has passed away. So he goes back to the funeral and you can see the heartache on his face when he finds out that Carol, who another reason he wanted to go back to town to visit, has also passed as well. And you see the heartache on his face and it's just so well done. And of course, later on, whilst he's going back to his old home, he discovers Carol's daughter, who's played by the same actress, Mika Borum. And, you know, they kind of sort of form a little bond there as well. And also kind of bringing closure to both their lives in this one quick scene, because she's also hurting that her mum has passed on. But yet, with him being there and knowing, like, oh, you're the kid that my mum used to talk about all the time. It also kind of brings closure to her grief as well.
Yeah.
Because she got to know her mum a bit more.
Yeah. And this thing is, everything I think is just handled so, so well that I just think it's such a beautiful film. I really loved this one. And again, I think it just hit me really, really hard this time. It really did.
Yeah. I think it would for a lot of people now knowing, like, again, having Anton Yelchin having been passed these past 5 years and the legacy that he's left behind with so many films, I think it's an important, like I even said with App to people, like even regardless of, you know, all the stuff behind the scenes and Bryan Singer, I still think that film should definitely be watched because it's such an interesting little film. But I would definitely wholeheartedly recommend this film. And I feel because just to show people just even at 11 years old, just how talented of an actor Anton Yelchin was. And
he really was.
He was just, yeah, I will admit I was very much misty-eyed through a lot of this film, but particularly the third half because of just how good, not only how great of a performance he's giving and how moving it is, but also the fact that he's now gone. And it's also that sense of sadness that we're never going to have any more performances from him. And that's sort of like definitely added a lot to it. But I think even then, like App Pupil, this is for me definitely one of the more underrated Stephen King adaptations, even though it did actually well at the time it came out, like like moderately well, but it's kind of forgotten over time. But I think people should definitely go back and rediscover this film because it is just so beautiful and moving, and it's even better than I remembered.
Yeah, this one I loved back when I first saw it, but I think I love it even more now. It just really hit me like a ton of bricks, everything with it. And again, I think this is, this could be one of like my favorite sort of works that I guess we've covered for the podcast. It is so different because, you know, it's not like we see anybody's dead body in this one.
Well, I think it's one of the rare like Stephen King adaptations where no one on screen actually dies. Like if any characters had died, they were like before the story ever happened.
So it's quite something quite different. It's like a Stand By Me in a way where it's this it kind of explores interesting themes with, you know, really great actors in it, and it's very emotional. It packs one of those emotional gut punches. But yeah, I just think this is a beautiful, wonderful film. Like I really do. And if people haven't seen this for a while or you've never seen it, absolutely go watch it or revisit it. It's worth it. I just think it's one of the most, you know, amazing films. Such a, you know, pleasure to discuss it on the podcast as well. And I'm just babbling like a moron. So yeah.
That's all right though.
Yeah. You know how I get. I could barely get my words out talking about Stand By Me, so blah.
Indeed. You wouldn't want to do a double feature of this and Stand By Me back to back, because you'd just be a puddle of just tears.
Yeah, I'd be a mess. I wouldn't be leaving the house for like 2 years.
Definitely. And I probably will be the same as well.
But yeah, that kind of wraps up our awesome talk on this amazing film. And ratings time. Out of 5, I am giving this 4.5 little cute Anton Yelchins out of 5.
I'm going to give this one 4 out of 5. Like I said, I think it's beautifully directed by Scott Hicks, who, of course, you know, I said made Shine, so, you know, he's definitely got a lot of good cred for this film. And, of course, William Goldman did such a wonderful job writing this film. Like, it does have a little bit of some of the same type of things we've seen in other Stephen King works, like the sort of the hallmarks, particularly stuff with, you know, like the more nostalgic stuff like Stand By Me and all that. But I still think it's still really well done here. It's just a beautiful story. It's moving without being overly or manipulatively, I probably said that word wrong, so forgive me, sentimental. Like it actually does tug at the heartstrings, and they're just full of such great performances. And great as Anthony Hopkins is in this film, and it's definitely one of his most beautifully subtle performances, it really is just a brilliant showcase just how early of a great actor Anton Yelchin was.
Yeah, just really, really fantastic. And yeah, that's a wrap on episode 21 of the King Zone podcast. Thank you to those who have tuned in to listen. We hope you enjoyed it and maybe have convinced you to watch a film you haven't seen before or rewatch a film if it's been a while.
Indeed.
I know Quicksilver Highway was kind of like the odd one out, but, you know, we put films together and then sometimes it ends up being, you know, some films have more in common than others, but I digress.
Indeed.
That is our episode. And, of course, you can always find us at supermarcy.com. We are on all the social medias, of course. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join the Facebook group, which you can look up under the Super Network group. We're also on Twitter at @SM_supernetwork. You can find us on YouTube under the Super Network. You can find us on TikTok under the Super Network. You can find us on Instagram at the.super.network. And, of course, you can join our Patreon to show and offer some support, as well as get ad-free and early access to podcasts and video podcasts on occasion and bonus content. And you can check that out at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. And if you want to find me personally, you can check me out on Twitter under Supermarcy or Letterboxd @super_Marcy. And of course, all our podcasts, including this one, Just search the name. You will find them on all your major podcast streaming platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, etc., etc. And Beat, what about you?
Well, if people want to find me, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeatJamine, or my personal writer's page on Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And of course, you can find me at Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/BeatJamine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns. And I am way behind on my next edition of Bad Movie Tweetathon. I should have done my Halloween edition and also the November edition of the shows of the column. So I'm going to have to do those two plus the Christmas one for December this year. Apologies that I've been a bit late. It's just most of October and November have been very busy times for me. I imagine December is probably going to be even more so, but we're going to definitely, I'll get all those out, those columns out and some other stuff. And of course, we'll also bring you a lot of podcasts as well when we have spare time with another King Zone in December, and also some other podcasts as well.
Yeah, we'll see how we go, but we will be back soon. Never fear. This is a monthly podcast, and you shouldn't have to wait, you know, more than maybe 5 weeks to get a show, but we will do our best. Sometimes this time of year just gets very busy. So until next time, I've been Super, Bede's been terrible, and stay away from weird chattering teeth.
Indeed. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Is that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Is that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you said we'll part. Is that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. Oh, well, goodbye. Although I'll cry. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain.
Face right. March. March. Okay, that's enough. Stop.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do. And now back to the show.